coming to you from wherever it is the Blue Wizards got to, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Rissa,
yes.
Do you have a fun fact for us?
I do have a fun fact. I'm very excited about this fun fact because this fun fact is that I am deeply in love and her name is Wonder Woman. Oh my god, guys. I love this movie so much. I love every single character in it. I love them.
Oh my gosh,
I love them all. I'm glad you guys have heard this. When I first planned on talking about this, neither of you had seen the film yet, so I was going to be like, I don't care if they've seen it, we're talking about Wonder Woman. But I'm glad that you both have. If anyone listening to this hasn't seen Wonder Woman, please go watch it immediately and get this blessing into your life.
Oh, it's extremely
it's
good.
So good. It's so good.
Someone was like, I thought I was a little over the top, and I'm no. like, maybe you're over the top.
That's like someone said, I think Chris Pine falls in love with her too quickly. And I was like, impossible. It's impossible to fall in love with her too quickly. No, but I love this film so much. And I am not a super DC fan, especially not of their films, because...
Ugh, nor I.
I just, there aren't... That's not true. There's one DC movie I really like. Is the Lego Batman movie. But the rest of them suck. Also, the last Batman Superman movie was one of the worst things I've ever seen, and even Diana didn't save it. Which is saying something.
That's sad.
Mostly well, because they just everything. Treated her poorly. Especially Batman. Oh, I hate the new Batman. Okay. I'm really sad because the next movie that Wonder Woman is going to be in is Justice League, and I hate this Batman.
Yeah, we're going to have to put up with that.
Yeah. Anyway, can we please... I love Wonder Woman so much.
That's not a fun fact, Rissa.
That is a fun fact
that's
for
just...
me.
Okay.
It's the you fact is actual... about me. No, this is my fact. The fact is I am in love. That is the fact of the day. Anyway, I can give like a quick what I love about Wonder Woman and then we can move on.
Yeah, go for it.
Go for it. Okay. Top three things you love about Wonder Woman.
One, Gal Gadot. Oh my god. This woman is a Agreed. Goddess. Oh, wait. Oh, I'm gonna use these up too quickly. Two, Robin Wright. Oh my god. Three, though, really, I love the message of Wonder Woman. I'm gonna spoil everything if you haven't seen it yet. But this message of the world does not deserve you is, one, that's a very good message. And two, the kind of second message about... kind of, I know it sounds really cliche, but this whole love triumphing over hate thing, but the fact that this is set in World War I, the fact that she is primarily trained as a warrior, you don't expect that whole love wins message to have an actual effect on her actions. It
right.
usually just gets thrown in as the good guys won, but it's like, no, the good guys won because of love and compassion and forgiveness, and that's abnormal. I've talked to people about how Wonder Woman I see as a significantly better kind of Christ-like figure than Superman. And Superman, I feel, tries super hard. Superman has the worst messiah complex you've ever seen. But Wonder Woman doesn't. She just gets the job done.
Point of order. The creators have the worst messiah complex. The creators of
That's
Superman
true.
Think he does.
Yeah.
Superman himself... is a farm boy who's just trying to do his best.
That's true.
Yeah.
And you can see that come out really strongly in the actual Batman versus Superman or whatever it was called film, Dawn of Justice. Because I think Batman, that whole film is about the fact that Batman and Lex Luthor both think that Superman has a god complex and Superman doesn't. But because they think he does, everything bad happens. But so
and also if Batman was actually Batman, he'd take 10 minutes to talk to Clark and figure out if it was true or not. I'm fine. I'll be fine.
I know, I agree. But so I'm gonna buy myself another one of these and say number one reason is the actresses, because yes. I'll put Chris Pine in there too. He can be an actress for
the
day.
Plus Chris Pine.
Two, I just really love the message. But three, what was the last female-led superhero movie? I think it was Elektra? And let's not pretend like that was good.
It was the Powerpuff Girls movie, which actually was.
Made a movie? I didn't know they made a Powerpuff Girl. Anyway, it was very good. Oh, here. I remember when I first watched it, the kind of line that really hit home for me, the line that made me think, this is the movie we need. How has it been so long? This is the message I need everyone to hear, is actually near the beginning, whenever Antiope is training Diana, and she just keeps repeating, you're stronger than this, you're stronger than this. And I was like, when is the last time we have ever heard a story in which a little girl is constantly told, you're strong, you're stronger than this, you're braver than this, you're stronger than this. Little boys get that all the time in stories.
Yeah.
And little girls don't. Never. And that really, I think, was the moment that I was like, oh man, I'm gonna cry. This is amazing. This is what I need in my life. Like, one, seeing it visually and the character of Diana in general, but two, the way people treat Diana is really just phenomenal. Or at least the way the good guys treat her.
Yeah, I grew up, when I was younger, there was this series of books that was popular, and it was supposed to be all about encouraging people, but the message of the books was that the main things guys need to hear is you can do it, and the main things girls need to hear is you're pretty and desirable.
That's the yes. And so, people act like that, and it's disgusting, yeah, and I hate it.
And I remember hearing this as a kid when I would hear people talking about, oh, I read these books, and they were so encouraging. I remember thinking, but I want to be told I can do it.
It is high time for a colloquium.
Yes, please.
Marissa, if you will pause on Wonder Woman for a second, and I promise to eventually talk about an ancient Wonder Woman.
Yay!
Will you let me talk about more about Turkey?
I would love that. Yes,
oh,
please.
Oh, please. Please do, Cleo.
Okay, so last time I talked about the Trojan War.
Yeah, it was cool learning that Troy was like we know where it is. I had no idea. I thought that was like a great mystery. We didn't know where it was, but we do.
We do.
I thought the interconnectedness of the historical narrative was interesting. Like, it's something I'd never thought about.
Yeah.
Troy had like writing letters to other ancient civilizations.
That's one of my favorite things about history, is sometimes we tend to break it off into, okay, we're going to study this empire and this empire and this empire, and because they're so big, we kind of have to, in order to get some grasp on them, we have to kind of break them off by themselves, but then there's this tendency to maybe forget that they existed at the same time and pretty much kind of in the same places, and they did interact and they did know each other. It's that big interconnected narrative that I love.
Yeah.
I promised last time that I was going to talk about Greek colonies in Asia Minor. Just as a review, what is now called Turkey has also been known as Asia Minor, Anatolia.
I didn't know about Anatolia. That one's a new one.
Yes.
Yeah, I feel like I'd heard that before, but I didn't know that that was Asia Minor.
So I'm probably going to use these interchangeably, and I want to keep reviewing them to make sure everyone knows where in the world we are.
Cool.
But
thanks, Carmen Sandiego.
You're welcome.
I love Carmen Sandiego so much.
I know you do.
She's amazing.
So in Asia Minor, we had Greek colonies, and I was very frustrated trying to research this because I couldn't find pinpoint an exact range of dates. We know that there was more than likely some Greek interaction between Asia Minor and the Hittites at the time of the Trojan War, which was somewhere between 1300 and 1240 BC. However, everything I'm reading and listening to and watching in research for this dates the real period of Greek colonization around the time of the 700s, which is when Homer actually wrote the Iliad.
Okay.
And the Odyssey. So I'm wondering if maybe there were just like early waves of colonization or something.
Wait, so last time you said that the Iliad and Odyssey were like written down way, way, way after the events they describe happened.
Yes.
Yeah, about 700 years.
So we know there was a city, Troy, that was like sacked and stuff. Was it not the Greeks that did it?
Well, if the Achaeans or the Ahiawans were the same people, and the Ahiawa was what was mentioned in the Hittite text.
Wait, sorry, are those the attackers?
Those would be the
right?
Greeks, yes. the Achaean Greeks mentioned by Homer that came and attacked Troy.
So they are Greek.
Yes. Either way, sometime between the time of the Trojan War and the time when the Iliad and the Odyssey were written down in the 700s, there was this wave of Greek colonization throughout the Mediterranean. They went to Egypt, they went to Italy, they went to the coast of Asia Minor, and they built all these Greek cities. And this was prompted by several different factors, probably a desire to expand trade, perhaps in competition with Phoenicians, a desire to have more farmland, because there's only so much farmland in mainland Greece, and they had a practice of, well, they had this practice of passing down their land by splitting it equally between everybody, and eventually if you do that, you run out of land a lot faster than if you just pass it down to, like, the firstborn son.
Yeah.
Because then they have to split it between all their heirs, and so on and so forth.
So it's equitable, but at what cost?
Yeah. So, the Greeks built these colonies throughout the Mediterranean. We're going to be talking about some of the ones in Asia Minor and their connections to... I'm basically just going to give you a crash course of classical Asia Minor from Greek colonies up through the Roman Empire and talk about famous touch points. So, fasten your seatbelts, because we're about to go really fast.
I'm psyched.
Let's Greek- go!
Greek cities in Asia Minor include such places as Ephesus, Troy, Miletus, Lesbos, Samos.
I've heard of those.
Yes. And one of the most famous was the city of Miletus, known to the Hittites as the city of Milowata or Milowanda. Miletus was very rich and powerful, and actually, after being a colony itself, helped found several colonies around the Mediterranean. I read somewhere between 70 and 90 other cities came out of the city of Miletus, including a lot around...
Whoa!
Yeah, including a lot around the area of the Black Sea.
Wow.
So, yeah, there were Greeks...
That's so many.
It's a lot. And that's just from Miletus. That's not counting all the other ones. That's not counting the ones in Italy and Egypt.
Whew.
Yes. The Greeks cities in Asia Minor, from what I can gather, were rather independent until around the 500s BC. And this is when in 559, over in what is now Iran, a man named Cyrus the Great rose to power and founded the Persian Achaemenid dynasty.
Ooh, that sounds important.
It was very important to the Persians. So Cyrus sets out to conquer the known world. He makes it to Asia Minor and conquers the Greek cities in Ionia. By the way, if I didn't mention before, the Greek region of Turkey, the west coast of Turkey, is called Ionia. And as well as the islands right off the coast, they are included.
That's where Ionic Greek gets its name, I
It is. Yeah. So he conquers
Not
Ionia.
Not to be confused with Ionic bonds.
I'm sorry?
No, don't worry about it.
Oh, this is a science reference, isn't it? Don't be sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't understand your science reference. I am not science clever.
Two or three of our listeners will think that's great.
Cool. I'm happy for those people.
So Cyrus conquers Ionia in 550 BC, which means that he is now the overlord of all these Greek cities. And despite the fact that they say he is a very just and fair ruler, they don't really like being conquered by the Persians.
You know, it's not great, that's for sure.
Despite freedom of religion and probably a good measure of autonomy, they just don't like the fact that the Persians are in charge.
I don't think I would either.
In 499, a man named Aristagoras from the city of Miletus leads a rebellion against Persian control in Ionia.
How well does that go?
Well, he makes an alliance with Athens, but it is ultimately quelled by Darius I, Cyrus's successor. Miletus is conquered and
is that also pronounced Darius?
Darius. I've heard it both ways.
Is that the same or a different guy from the Book of Daniel?
It's the same guy.
It's definitely the same dude.
Is it the same guy?
Yes.
Cool.
So he puts down the rebellion in the city of Miletus is captured, and in 494, all the men are killed and all the women and children are enslaved because, Miletus started the whole thing, so it's their fault.
Yikes.
Sheesh.
They didn't go after Athens like that?
Oh, we're getting there. Oh, okay. So, this is the beginning of what is known as the Greco-Persian Wars, and Darius is not happy that Athens got involved in his business.
Okay.
So he sets out to invade mainland Greece. He marches his army through until 490 BC, when he is defeated by the Athenian general Themistocles at the Battle of Marathon. He takes his army and starts off marching back home, but in the 4 years it takes him to get home, he dies in 486, and he is succeeded by his son Xerxes. Xerxes is also still mad at the Greeks, because not only did they get all up in his business, but they defeated his dad in the process.
Can I ask a question right quick?
Yes.
Is it abnormal that they marched over land as opposed to taking boats?
Well, that was, I mean, I don't know.
It sounds like there's a lot of marching and stuff going on, and that seems a little abnormal, based on what else I know about the place of Greece and their armies. So, okay, sorry.
There is a lot of marching, but remember they have the Hellespont they can get over. The straits of in between Asia Minor and mainland Europe. At this point, they also have Persian army stationed in the western coast of Turkey.
I have another question.
Yes.
Do we know anything about the amount of loyalty between mainland Greece and all of these colonies? Like, do they still consider themselves the same nation, or at least, you know, loosely affiliated?
They do consider themselves, from what I gather, loosely affiliated, which is how they were able to get Athens involved in the rebellion to begin with.
So it's less of a, hey, you're a city, we're a city, let's get together, yeah, yeah, yeah. And more like, hey, fellow Greeks, the Persians are all up in our business. Can you help us out?
Yeah, because at this point, Greek is less of a nation in the way we think of it today, and it's more of a lot of different, almost separate little kingdoms bound together by a common culture.
So
all these colonies, they don't all have the same government. They're not all democracies. Some of them are led by what were called tyrants or one-man governments. Mm-hmm. It really varies from place to place. You know, Athens is a big intellectual city. Sparta is a big city of war. Miletus is a big trade city. But they are still bound together by this common culture.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. So Xerxes, who is still not happy with the Greeks, decides he's going to launch his own invasion of Greece in 480. And this is probably the most famous part of the Greco-Persian Wars, because this is where we get things like the Battle of Thermopylae.
Yay! I know this one.
With Leonidas and his 300 Spartans, which... Fighting in the shade and in the mountains, not naked, despite what Hollywood would have us believe.
Wow, I haven't seen the movie 300, but now I'm not. I have even more doubts.
They weren't completely naked in the movie, but they might as well have been, and it's annoying because no one goes into battle like that.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit more about the Battle of Thermopylae? Because I learned about it once in middle school, and now.
So the Battle of Thermopylae took place in a very narrow mountain pass. One thing I read said that it was so narrow, only one chariot could get through the pass at a time. So Xerxes comes through with his tens of thousands of Persian warriors, anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000, depending on which ancient historian you believe. There is a Spartan force of warriors led by King Leonidas of Sparta. He has about 300 men, and they are put in charge of holding this pass.
Oh, so they bottleneck them, and do they win?
They do not win. They are eventually betrayed by a Greek defector, who shows the Persians how to get around the pass, and all 300 of them are killed. However, it does give time for the rest of the Greek army to regroup off the shores of off the coast of Athens at the Battle of Salamis. Unfortunately for Athens, by the time Xerxes gets there, he's really, really mad, and he orders worse than he was before. He orders Athens.
Golly, I'm just steamed about this.
He orders Athens to be burned to the ground. Which is, not really normal for the Persians. They didn't tend to go around wreaking total havoc on places like that. But
they'd rather keep them and make money.
Exactly. The Greek navy off the coast of Athens in the Bay of Salamis lures the Persian navy into a confrontation. However, what the Persian navy underestimates is how big their ships are and how tiny the bay is.
Wait, they underestimate the size of their own ships?
Well, it's just the Persian ships are too big to really maneuver very well in the Bay of Salamis, so these lighter, smaller Greek ships are able to get in there and ram into the boats and throw Greek fire and set things on fire. And
so the Greeks managed to, like, make a name for themselves in these battles by virtue of being small and scrappy?
Yes, and they are once again led by Themistocles, who at this point is, I don't know, he's probably just wishing that Xerxes' family would leave him alone.
You make him just sound like this poor man.
Poor Themistocles, isn't he sad?
He was actually a really brilliant general. Fun fact, one of the Greek oracles had prophesied that Greeks would be saved from the Persians by a wall of wood, which, if you know anything about oracles, they're known for giving really obscure prophecies that people are like, well, this could end well, but it could not. How are we going to be saved by a wall of wood? Turns out, after the Battle of Salamis, everyone interpreted that to say the wall of wood is actually the ships of the Greek navy who defeated the Persians and saved us from invasion.
I love a good prophecy you can twist to mean anything.
Love it. It's great. So the Greeks are victorious in this battle. They send the Persians back to Persia. However, Persia does maintain control of Asia Minor, including those Greek cities. And this is basically, from what I can tell, how things are in Asia Minor until the year 336 BC. And this is when...
A while.
It's about 100 years, a little over 150 years.
Okay.
In 336, a young 20-year-old man from Macedonia named Alexander becomes king, and he sets out to conquer the world.
He cuts through a knot, and he's like, this has been a good day. Why don't I conquer the entire known world? That's how that goes, right?
Exactly. So his armies start marching and conquering in 334. He arrives in Asia Minor and starts liberating the Greek cities. He is hailed as a liberator from Persian control.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Remember, Alexander very heavily identifies with Greek culture. He considers himself a descendant of Achilles. He visits Troy. He visits the tombs of Achilles and Patroclus. He takes Achilles' shield from the historical museum of Troy.
Rude.
Why you do this, Alexander?
Because he's descended from Achilles, and he's going to march into battle and conquer the world with Achilles' shield.
Oh, good luck with that.
Hannah, get with the program.
Because that's what you do when you're 22. He did do a really good job. His empire eventually spread from Macedonia to Afghanistan, from Egypt to India.
Poof!
And he spread Greek culture. It is very big. He spread Greek culture and the Greek language wherever he went, to the point where if you go to Afghanistan today, that's why you'll see people with blue and green eyes.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was going to say, when you say spread culture, did they, like, colonize these places? Did he, like, send settlers?
He brought large numbers of people with him. He built cities, but he also highly encouraged intermarriage between his soldiers and the local population.
Interesting.
Not usual.
Yeah. No. He defeats Darius III in 330 and conquers the Persian capital at Persepolis. However, 7 years later, in 323, Alexander dies with no heir. His empire is divided into independent kingdoms, and this also happens in Asia Minor, where we see lots and lots of small independent kingdoms spring up, and these kingdoms really kind of rule the roost in Asia Minor until 133 BC, and that is when King Attalus of Pergamum the city-state of Pergamum in Asia Minor dies. When he dies, he does something very interesting. He wills his entire kingdom to his neighbor.
Oh, what?
Specifically, a neighboring kingdom. You may have heard of it. It's this tiny little village that was founded in 735 BC on the banks of the Tiber River.
Oh no.
He left.
Wait, he just willed it, like, to the other ruler, or?
He willed the kingdom of Pergamum to Rome.
Hey, hey, Ted, you've been a great neighbor. Please, when I die, take my house. Like, wow. Why?
And this is, I'm not really sure.
Was there just, did he not like anyone in his kingdom that could possibly have taken it?
I don't know.
You all suck but so just, bad.
Screw you guys.
This kingdom to Rome.
But he does, and this is how the Roman Republic gets a foothold in Asia Minor. So at this point, the Roman Republic had conquered the Mediterranean from 265 to 146 is when they really set about conquering all of Italy and the Mediterranean. They conquer mainland Greece in 272. And when they finally, thanks to Attalus, get a foothold in Asia Minor, they do start spreading their influence and spreading their control throughout Asia Minor. This is not really welcomed. No one likes being conquered by Rome, because
no liberation argument no, can be made here.
You thought the Persians were bad. Now you are being conquered by Rome.
And they're way better organized.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the Persians were pretty well organized, too. But, okay,
yeah, that's, I don't know.
Rome had
because
more of a...
Rome is just famous for
more it. Had Rome, Rome had more of a penchant for burning things to the ground and sowing fields with salt than the Persians did.
Oh, not great.
But eventually, the peoples of Asia Minor decide they don't want to be ruled by the Roman Republic.
Same.
They just don't like that. So, under the leadership... Same. Of a man we have discussed before, there Ooh. Is staged a rebellion in 88 BC against Roman control in Asia Minor, led by the King of Pontus, the Poison King,
Ooh.
Mithridates IV.
My dude!
Your, dude, the yeah, same guy?
The same guy, yes.
That's awesome! By we way, did that on purpose.
Order, I think in that episode I called him Mithridates VI, and it's because I can't read Roman numerals, and I'd like to apologize for that.
Wait, what was he?
Mithridates IV, or Mithridates IV, the Poison King, organized throughout Asia Minor.
Poison?
Not poison, but genocide.
That too, but...
just
basically,
genocide.
Him and all his allies got together and... staged an uprising whereby anyone who even spoke with a Latin accent was killed.
What? I don't like him anymore.
They think that over 80,000 Roman citizens and people were killed in this first Mithridatic War. There were three. But...
Yeah, that sounds like him.
I don't like him anymore.
Yeah, Rome...
I take it back.
Did...
It was
probably kill his own family to avoid capture.
He
with
did.
Poison.
He did kill his own family with poison to avoid capture.
So I'm Take unsurprised by his genocidal tendencies.
This was quite devastating, especially because one of the things that he did was that there was no quarter. The Latins and the Romans took refuge in temples because this was typically a sacred space that no one would commit bloodshed in. That didn't work this time. They went into the temples and killed them anyway. Rome, as you can imagine...
That's so not okay.
Yeah. Rome, as you can imagine, was less than thrilled by this. And...
What? Shocking.
They just were not happy about this. Rome does not like to be challenged. And so they did send
also
out
shocking.
They did send out the army, and so from 88 BC to 64 BC there were a series of three wars that they fought against Mithridates and his allies.
Wow.
Yeah, so Mithridates was quite more successful, I believe, in the first two of them. He also, at some point, I believe, tried to make an ally out of the Roman gladiator Spartacus. So Spartacus was leading a slave revolt in the Italian peninsula. He was a runaway gladiator who ended up with an army of about 70,000 runaway slaves.
So that is a lot!
He eventually lost too, as did Mithridates.
The cool guys always lose.
They do. He committed suicide. in order to avoid capture, yes. But unfortunately, as we mentioned before, because he had dabbled so much in poison in an attempt to find an antidote, he was unsuccessful in killing himself and had to ask someone to stab him.
Or he stabbed himself.
Or he stabbed himself. Either way. So Rome is victorious over Mithridates. After this, they really solidify their control in Asia Minor. The Roman Empire...
Yeah, that would about
do it. Yeah. Rome becomes an empire around 31 BC. That's the installation of the first Roman emperor. And
I was going to say, is it not an empire before that? Because they sure did conquer a lot, but I guess it was a republic before.
Their system of government was a republic. They switched to a one-man emperor around 31 BC. Caesar Augustus... Yay. Like him.
I know about him.
The Senate.
What?
Was that a Star Wars quote?
I don't know what you're talking about. That was Caesar Augustus.
What did you say?
It sounded like Emperor Palpatine.
No.
What? No.
No. The Roman Empire eventually is divided by Diocletian in 285, and the eastern capital is moved to Byzantium in Asia Minor. What we now know as the city of Istanbul. Byzantium, after the fall of Rome, became the repository of what was left of Roman law and culture, and really kept those traditions going there in Asia Minor, in Turkey. So that's kind of a really, really quick overview. Like I said, it's going to be a fast preview, but it really lets me get to what I want to talk about, which is famous people from Asia Minor in this period. Because there's a lot of them. So, without further
ado... We've already mentioned several,
but without further ado, people you didn't know came from Turkey.
Got it. I'm ready.
So, from the city of Ephesus, the pre-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus, most famous for his idea that everything is made of fire.
Gotta love that. Until the Fire Nation attacks.
Yes.
Incorrect, but fascinating.
From the famous city of Miletus, the pre-Socratic philosophers Thales, Anaximander, and Anaximenes.
Oh, those guys are fun.
Bless you.
Yes.
Yeah, accurate.
The architect and city planner Hippodamus, who was the first person to design a city on a grid structure, a format.
Say he designed a dam.
Wait, no, he was the first one. Nobody thought of that before.
Not
yeah, I've got an
at
idea.
Least
maybe
at
we
least
should
in
make
the West.
Streets.
Yeah, on a grid, which is a format that we still use today.
Yeah.
Unless you're in Missoula, where you take the middle part of the city and you just rotate it 45 degrees.
What?
I'm not even joking.
But which city did he? Which was the first city he designed like that?
Miletus.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh.
From the Ionian island of Samos off the coast of Turkey, the famous philosopher and mathematician Pythagoras.
Love him. I know that guy.
Yes. Also,
my favorite thing about Pythagoras is that he thought that beans were people.
What?
He thought they had souls. He didn't necessarily think they were people, but he thought they had souls.
Well, I mean, Aristotle thought that plants had souls. I mean, to
no,
be honest,
but like
I'm
beans in particular, as opposed to other plants.
Just beans. No. Just beans. Why?
Also, he was reportedly murdered in a field of beans by the locals who didn't like him very much. Sad day.
I did not know that. The things you learn on this podcast.
Also from the island of Samos, Melissus, the philosopher who was also a naval commander who defeated Athens in a naval battle. Go him.
Nice.
From the city of Colophon, the philosopher Xenophanes.
Oh, I know that one.
Yes.
I don't, actually. What kind of stuff did he say?
He was one of the Eleatic philosophers, so from the same school as Parmenides.
Yes. Yes, I have read this guy. Yeah. I do not like him.
You did read him. We read him in Ancient and Medieval,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
I think I just wiped him from my mind because I didn't like him.
I kept him in there because Xenophanes is a fun thing to say.
That is thing to say.
From the Byzantine Empire... From the city of Byzantium, Emperor Justinian I, Justinian the Great, who codified the Roman law legacy and preserved it for future generations. His wife, Empress Theodora, who worked for the right to expand the rights of women.
Nice.
Just a little tiny side plug. Extra Credits show Extra History has a really great series about those two.
They were some pretty cool people.
They were awesome.
Theodora was she wasn't a prostitute. She was like a public performer, which was considered the same thing. Because
actresses.
She was an actress, yes.
I mean,
also
they were considered that way at the time and for a long time, unfortunately.
Yeah, also from Byzantium, Isidorus, originally from Miletus, and Anthemius of Tralles, another Asia Minor Anatolian city, they were architects of the Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, which is now the Blue Mosque in Istanbul. But what I really wanted to talk about was, first of all, my boy from the city of Halicarnassus, Herodotus.
That's a great name.
Halicarnassus is a great name. Herodotus was the historian of the Greco-Persian Wars. He wrote a 9-book series on the Greco-Persian Wars, each of them named after the 9 muses, the first named after the muse of history, Cleo.
Hey! It's like you did it on purpose.
Herodotus starts off his story by saying, you know, basically everyone has a different view on how the Greco-Persian War started. The Persians, for example, blame it on the Phoenicians.
Do they?
Yeah. Okay, so Herodotus blames the Greco-Persian Wars in part on the Trojan War, because apparently, for some reason, what happened was the Phoenicians, these great traders of the Mediterranean, went to Greece and kidnapped a Greek princess.
Ooh, why?
Because she was hot.
This sounds exactly like how Troy started. Don't these people learn anything?
It is, because apparently Alexander the Great, basically what happened was the Phoenicians kidnapped a Greek princess, and then the Greeks went over to Tyre or Sidon and kidnapped a Phoenician princess, and Alexander the Great got Alexander of Troy got really upset about that, so 10 years later he went...
Wait, I thought Alexander of Troy was Paris of Troy.
He is.
Oh, hey!
Herodotus is saying, potentially, I'm not entirely sure, but it almost reads like Herodotus doesn't think the Trojans were entirely Greek.
Oh,
which is a theory we talked about last time. Were the Trojans actually ethnically Greek, or were they simply associated with the Greeks?
Okay.
So, Alexander does not like that the Greeks kidnapped this princess, so he goes over and he's like, well, I'm just going to take Helen. And he does that. The Greeks come over and they conquer Troy, which makes the Persians mad because they consider themselves the protectors of all of Asia Minor. And this, according...
This is arguing that this spat between the Persians and the Greeks has been going on since 1500s.
Before Troy.
Since, like, before the Persian Empire.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Seems unlikely, but okay.
Fortunately, ancient historians have never been known to exaggerate or... embellished details. So this is an entirely factual retelling of the beginning of the Greco-Persian Wars. But yeah,
wouldn't that be nice?
One of the good things Herodotus has to say about the Persians is about the efficiency of their postal service. He is credited for the famous phrase, "Neither rain nor snow nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds." This is widely believed to be the motto of the U.S. Postal Service. It's not.
Isn't it?
The U.S. Postal Service doesn't have an official motto. But it was carved into a monument in the 1800s or 1900s. I think it was early 1900s. Carved into a monument to the U.S. Postal Service by a classic lover of classical things in New York.
When you say carved in, was this, like, officially carved in, or did he, like, graffiti the place?
Oh, no. He commissioned the monument, and because to the U.S. Postal Service. Why? I don't really know. because it's kind of a random thing to put up a monument to.
Good mail, Brant.
But because he was a lover of all things classical and Greek, he thought it would be a good kind of thing to put on the monument to the Postal Service, and ever since then, people have been under the impression that it's actually the Postal Service's motto. It's not.
I thought it was.
What is the Postal Service's motto?
They don't have one.
What?
Why not?
I don't know.
There's one waiting for them.
I don't know.
Why haven't they adopted it yet?
I don't know. But one other person that Herodotus liked to talk about a lot in his writings was a fellow person from his home city of Halicarnassus.
I thought you were just going to stop at fellow person.
Just he liked to talk about this other person. Yeah. So
I mean, it's a cool city name. I don't know why I didn't just talk about that.
I know. But they were also from...
How cool is my city's name?
They were also from born in Halicarnassus and later became the monarch of the kingdom of Caria, which is in northern Anatolia. We are talking about one of Xerxes' best naval commanders in the Greco-Persian War. She commanded an entire fleet of her own ships in the Battle of Salamis.
Yes, please.
Artemisia the First, Queen of Caria.
Yes, please.
Yes. All right, tell us about her.
So, please. Artemisia became queen when she took over after her husband died, and she became kind of the guardian ruler over her son, but she did rule as queen. And she was very highly respected as a naval commander. She went into battle for Xerxes as a loyal member of the Persian Empire. She was present at the Battle of Salamis, and she's most well known for realizing what was going on, having really the presence of mind to figure out how to get out of the Greek trap at Salamis. So she looked around and saw all the ships, the Persian ships, being sunk, saw one of her own ships in her personal fleet being sunk, and decided that the best thing to do would be to psych out the Greeks by ramming into her own other ship.
What?
Oh my gosh.
Wow. This created enough of a diversion to allow her to get out of the Bay of Salamis and head back towards Caria. The Greeks were utterly humiliated by this. They put out a bounty on her head. It was unsuccessful. And
this is perfect.
Yes. And Xerxes, apparently, when he was told this story of her successful escape, made the statement, "My men are becoming women, and my women are becoming men."
Y'all better shape up if you want to live up to Artemisia.
Yep. So,
awesome.
Like I said, I'm not a scholar of ancient Greece, and especially not of ancient Persia and ancient Rome, but that is my brief summary of the classical period in Asia Minor, along with some really cool people who came out of that area.
Yeah.
And, there's a lot of cool stories, and like you said, a lot of interaction, a lot of overlap in the stories.
That was a lot of cool things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Cleo.
Yeah, I really love that list of people, because it's just like, there's so many.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I absolutely did not realize any of those people were from Asia Minor.
Me neither. I thought they were, like, mostly from Greece.
Yeah, so actually, fun fact, I've been listening to this podcast on the history of philosophy, and listening to the sections on the pre-Socratics is what got me wanting to do this series, because the guy doing the podcast kept saying, and he was from here, and he was from here in Ionia, and I'm just like, hold on, they're all from Turkey.
I definitely thought that Ionia was in Greece.
I did too.
I mean, culturally it was, but geographically it was in Turkey, and that's kind of what started this whole series, so you can blame the History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps podcast on the fact that we are on episode however many of the history of Turkey.
That's cool.
Postgrad problem time, I guess.
Go for it. What are your problems? Unburden your soul.
Everything.
Well, okay, so the one I'm dealing with right now, that I have an undergrad who is working under me now.
Ooh.
As they do. So I am a graduate student in chemistry, in analytical chemistry, working on a research project. We have, there's this program in chemistry programs all across the nation called REUs, which is just research experience for undergrads. And it's basically like, you get a little bit of funding to bring an undergrad in, give them a place to live, and a little stipend for food, and then they get to come and work in your lab, and they're basically a grunt, and they do whatever for, anything between 6 to 10 weeks. We've got ours for 8 weeks, and it's good because a lot of the... Okay, so I did two of them when I was an undergrad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did one at my undergrad college for one of my professors, and that was... They didn't have any funding. I just, like, stuck around during the summer.
Wow.
Yeah, which is kind of nice. And then I did one at the University of Georgia, too. And the thing about REUs is that...
I remember that because you came to see me.
I did! I spent my 4th of July in Nashville, which is a place I'd never been. So that was
so fun.
And came and saw Cleo, and that was wonderful.
So, wait, what's your problem, then? You have one of these undergrads, right?
Right, yeah. So, the good thing about these REU programs is that you get hands-on experience doing things like synthesizing nanoparticles or testing the effectiveness of tuberculosis drugs, both of which are things I did as an undergrad.
Nice.
I just... How do you mentor?
Oh.
How do mentor?
I've taken, like, a class on this, and I still don't know.
I was one.
A class on mentoring?
I was one for a semester, and I still don't know.
That's an excellent question.
A Nestor semester?
No.
Sorry.
Is that, like, your stated, like, you are the mentor, or are you teaching them? Like, I think those two are different things.
Yes. Okay, so it's not, like, a formal setup. Technically, she belongs. She doesn't belong to anyone. Okay, so she is working for the lab.
Yes.
It just so happens that one of our students is leaving on a postdoc, one of them is spending his summer writing, one of them is about to graduate, like, defend her thesis and leave. One of them already has an undergrad, and then there's me.
Aha.
I'm the only one doing,
She's been assigned to you, basically.
Yes, so she's been assigned to help me with my... Oh, and then there's another guy who she could work for, technically, but he's more engineering-focused, and anyway, he's also already got an undergrad.
Okay. So, in other words, you have charge of this person...
Yes.
Now, you know these programs. When you were in these programs, were you, like, mentored or just taught or, like, what?
Well, that's the troubling thing because in the first one, there were no mentors at all. There were no graduate students in chemistry at our undergrad because
right.
there's no graduate chemistry program at our undergrad.
Right.
So, basically, the professor said, here is a synthesis strategy. Go make me some R-ones. And I did. And it didn't always work, but sometimes it did. And then we would dab it on some stuff to see if the tuberculosis didn't like it. And that was my undergraduate research and that's what I did with my summer.
Wow.
So, and then in the second one, it was more like, this is what I'm working on, but I'm pretty sure that a graduate student I was assigned to, and that was also working on writing, so he didn't have much for me to do except try the same two or three syntheses of nanoparticles over and over again until I got it right. And I very rarely got it right.
And how was that? Like, did you hate it? Did you learn from it?
I learned from it. I actually really liked it because I didn't have proper homework, so I could go home and not think about it anymore.
That is nice.
Yeah, it was kind of nice. And I definitely learned from it. I learned a lot about nanoparticles. I learned a lot about synthesis and lab procedure. You know, the application of the things you learn about in theory in the classroom. And, you know, you have labs in chemistry classes, but you don't necessarily make the same connections that you do. Like, an analytical lab, for example, is all about measuring things and precision. And, you know, if you accidentally... contaminate something in your general chemistry lab, you don't get to try it again until you get it right. You just get a bad grade. And then you never get to try it again. You're on to the next thing. So, yeah, the repetitiveness of it, the precision of getting things right, is something I definitely valued and learned from. And it was kind of frustrating at times, but honestly, I just really enjoyed the work. I'm a huge nerd for lab, though. I've always loved lab, and that's not necessarily as common among chemists as you'd think.
Wow, okay. I mean, I guess I just did a postgrad problems about how I don't really like reading that much, so, maybe we're just opposites here.
Yeah, so my problem is how do I make this a good experience for her in the same way that my undergrad experiences were good? I want to help her grow as a chemist and a scientist and as a student, I guess. But I just don't know how.
I think one thing is realizing that that's not the same thing as mentoring.
Okay.
I think mentoring has a too much of a responsibility word to do what you are doing here. I think the first thing to do is talk to her. Is it her?
Yeah.
Talk to her. Maybe try and gauge or just ask what she is expecting from this and what she needs from this and if she's done one of these before and that kind of thing. That's where I would start.
That's a very good point. I have not done that. Why haven't I done that?
I think it's really valuable. Communication is really valuable, and it's really valuable to start on the same page. Because I think what would be the worst for her is if she came in expecting, ABC, and she ended up doing XYZ instead. And that can be good or bad. It could be better than she expected, or it can just ruin everything. So being on the same page can be really beneficial here. But two, mentorship is not the word I would use. Not that what you're doing isn't important, because it's not mentorship or whatever, but just if you had mentorship things, I would start talking about like setting boundaries and more personal stuff like that. But I don't think you are responsible for that personally.
Well, there is some of that involved, I think. But yeah, we are, I don't know, I'm in my second year of graduate school and I still don't know what the heck I'm doing sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're much more peers than I was with the graduate student I worked for at University of Georgia.
Would you be comfortable telling her that? That you don't know what you're doing half the time?
I mean, yes, I've already told her that.
Oh, cool. Get coffee. Talk about stuff like that.
But I think, and here's the trick, we've discussed this before, is that more than likely that graduate student you worked under felt the exact same way.
Yeah.
And so it's less of, I mean, I think what Rissa said is absolutely right. You need to talk to her and you need to ask her, what do you need from this and what are you expecting to get from this? But also evaluate what you think you should be doing versus what you should actually be doing, because it sounds like you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself to be like all-knowing science mentor guru when maybe she just wants someone who's further along to show her how they got there, and that's going to be much more organic than do I have a mentorship curriculum and a schedule and have we talked about our personality tests and whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
And ask her what her interests are in chemistry as well.
That is, why haven't I asked these questions? It all seems so obvious now.
Is this like the first time we've actually been able to kind of fix a postgrad problem?
Oh my gosh, we have a solution.
We have an actual answer to this.
But yeah, and I feel like obviously, like you said, there's going to be some mentoring that comes into that, but I think it's probably going to be more organic than you think, which is good, because you're in organic chemistry.
I'm not in organic chemistry.
You're not
in organic chemistry.
I'm not in inorganic chemistry.
Dang it!
Either.
I was so close!
This is why
what
I don't
are
do
you
science.
In? What? Wait, I thought those seem like pretty much that either it's organic or it's not organic. What are you doing, like, halvesies?
It's half alive!
Yeah. What are you doing?
Analytical chemistry.
Ah.
Okay.
Okay.
Which is, organic chemistry is, I'm gonna make organic chemicals. Inorganic chemistry is, I'm gonna make inorganic chemicals. We don't make chemicals at all. We test quality. It's quality control.
Okay.
Yeah. Quality control chemistry.
Yes.
So does that mean you basically have to learn both organic and inorganic chemistry to do it?
What? Yeah. Some of both, and also some physical chemistry, and also some a lot of instrumental. It's a lot of instrumental chemistry.
There are a lot more types of chemistry than I thought there were.
Oh yeah, everything has a sub-discipline. Welcome to academia.
Right? How are we done? Are we, like, what do we do now?
Yeah, unless you guys had other contributions.
No, I think getting to know her and what she expects is probably a great first step.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree.
I'm gonna do that then. That's a great idea.
Yay!
Thanks, guys.
Woohoo! We fixed it.
Yay. We fixed something. We were ambitious and for the first time successful.
What is that from?
Sorry, that's Top Gear. What else are we into?
I've got a good series of books.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. So there is a series of books called The Queen's Thief by Megan Whalen Turner.
Yes. You've been trying to get me to read these books for the past 6 years.
I think everyone should read these books. Unfortunately, I can't tell you anything about them because literally everything is a spoiler.
There's a thief and a queen, I bet.
There sure are those things.
So it's a fantasy book, right?
Sort of. All right, I would classify it, if it didn't demonize the whole thing, as political fantasy.
What? Mm.
Yes.
I mean, Game of Thrones is a political fantasy, isn't it?
I guess, but there's much less sex and death in this one.
Okay, that sounds good.
I mean, it's hard not to have less sex and death.
It's true.
But this is significant.
Have you read Greek tragedies?
That's fair.
We were just talking about Mithridates and...
Yeah.
It's funny, actually, that we are talking about Greek tragedies and Asia Minor, because the fantasy world that this is set in, you know, your classic fantasy setting is Anglo-ish.
Right.
Right.
That's accurate.
Northeastern Europe.
Northwestern Europe.
Yep. That's correct. That's what I meant. Northwestern Europe.
Yeah.
This is set much more in an Asia Minor, Greek sort of setting.
That sounds fun.
The stories are all about politics, but you wouldn't know it just looking at them. And it starts out with this thief, and his name is Jen, with a G, and he's in jail. And so someone pulls him out of jail and says, I want you to steal something for me, and if you do, we'll set you free, and if you don't, we'll send you to die in the coal mines.
Oh!
Yeah, and he's like, I choose life!
Are you sure that this is not, Moise von Lipwick over there?
I mean, it basically is, except with a twist that I don't think you'll see coming, because no one has yet.
Okay.
I have not met a single person who predicted the end of this book.
Well, then.
And every book is like that. And this is the first book.
How many are there?
There are currently 5. The author says that she plans on 6. The 5th one just came out, though, and it could be, like, 5 more years until the 6th one comes out.
What's the new one called?
The new one is called Thick as Thieves, and it is excellent. I stayed up till 3:45 3:15 reading it.
Yep, yes you did.
And I texted y'all when I did it.
I mean, I stayed up till 6 in the morning once reading Game of Thrones, so...
Yeah, you feel me.
But these are good books, is what you're saying, and everyone should read them.
Oh my gosh, yeah, gosh, yes, please read them. The first book is called The Thief. The second book is called The Queen of Atolia. That might help you find the first book. They're by Megan Whalen Turner. They're absolutely delightful. They just, like, it would be one thing if it was stunning political intrigue, and it is. But it's also, like, these really complex, interesting, lovable characters. There's not a single character in there that I don't just adore, even the bad guys.
That's awesome.
It's very good.
If you're listening to this and you read any of these books, please email Science so she has someone to talk about
them. Oh, please do.
Because me and Cleo haven't gotten around to reading them yet.
If you like Science's book suggestion, or if you need more incentives to read books this summer, my baby cousin, who's 7, is starting a book reading challenge. And it's for kids and adults, and right now he has over 200 people participating, and I'm very proud of him, so... Wow. If you would like to join the Clinton Challenge, you can email me, and I'll tell you how. And again, he came up with this all by himself, and it includes rules such as no Minecraft books, because he recognizes his own tendency to just sit around and read nothing but Minecraft books, and he said, I need to read something different.
I'm proud of him. I've never met him, but I am proud of him.
It's good to have an understanding of your own hubris.
Yeah.
Yeah. This kid's going places.
So thank you very much to Stan from Vintage Lab Tech for our music, and to Caitlin Thompson, who did our logo and design. We love them both. They're great.
They are.
I agree.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening.
Until next time, learn something worth knowing.